ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
So today we're going to read from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11. Let's see. Canto 11, Chapter 18, Verse 31. This is Krishna's instructions to Uddhava. So, Uddhava Gita. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. No Vijeta Janadiro. Janam Chod Vijaynatu. Ativadam Statiksheta. Nava manyeta kanchana. Deham ucha pasa pasuvad. Vairam kuryana kenachit. Okay. Na, never. Udvijeta. Should be disturbed or frightened. Janat, because of other people. Dira, a saintly person. Janam, other people. Cha, also. Udvijayet should frighten or disturb. Na, never. To, indeed. Ativadan, insulting or harsh words. Titiksheta, he should tolerate. Na, never. Avamanyeta, should be little. Kanchana, anyone. Deham, the body. Udisha, for the sake of. Pashuvat, like an animal. Vairam, hostility. Kuryat, he should create. Na, never. Kenachit, with anyone. Wow. It's a strange looking bug. A saintly person should never let others frighten or disturb him, and similarly, should never frighten or disturb other people. He should tolerate the insults of others, and should never himself belittle anyone. He should never create hostility with anyone for the sake of the material body, for he would thus be no better than an animal. Heavy. Please repeat. A saintly person should never let others frighten or disturb him. And similarly, should never frighten or disturb other people. He should tolerate the insults of others and should never himself belittle anyone. He should never create hostility with anyone for the sake of the material body, for he would thus be no better than an animal. Or an aminal, as my grandson says. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has stated, huh? You can't hear me? All right. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has stated, Trinadapi sunichena, tororapi sehishtuna, amanina manadena kirtaniya sadahari. One should chant the holy name of the Lord in a humble state of mind, thinking oneself lower than the straw in the street. One should be more tolerant than a tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige, and ready to offer all respects unto others. In such a state of mind, one can chant the holy name of the Lord constantly. Who spoke that? Yes. Very short comment here. A Vaishnava should never disturb any other living entity with his body, mind, or words. See, we shouldn't disturb another living entity with our mind. So thoughts are energy, thought forms. And on a subtle level, actually, we do disturb others with our own disturbance, right? We're disturbed, and that disturbance can actually disturb others. We can talk about that more, how that works. So a Vaishnava should never disturb any other living entity with his body, mind, or words. He should always be tolerant and never belittle others. Although a Vaishnava may act powerfully against the demons for Lord Krishna's sake, as did Arjuna, Hanuman, and other great devotees, a Vaishnava becomes very meek and humble in regard to his own reputation. So that's a Vaishnava. That's the end of the purport. Omagyanata mirandasya gananjana salakaya chaksurun militam yena tasmayin shri gurave namaha nama om vishnu padaya krishna prasthaya bhutale srimakti bhakti vedanta swamini tinamane namaste saraswati deve gaudavani pracharani nirvishesa sunyavadi pastacha deshitarani Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Shri Adwaita Garadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Vanchikapati Vyascha Krita Sanyuvi Vyascha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Could I have a little bit of water, please? Forgive Mike, I'm a little congested. Oh, it's right there. Thank you. I had one. I think this will be good. So, Krishna speaking to Uddhava. One more time. A saintly person should never let others frighten or disturb him. As you hear that, just think about how often you feel afraid in the presence of others. Some devotees have told me that they're actually afraid to share here. So what is that about? So oftentimes we're afraid about what others are, we're imagining what others are thinking about us, right? And that generates some fear. And then when we feel afraid, we seize up, right? Can't move. We stop ourselves. Even our life energy stops to flow, in a very real way. The heart closes. Yeah. So a saintly person should never let others frighten or disturb him. Similarly, one should never frighten or disturb other people. He should tolerate the insults of others and should never himself belittle anyone. He should never create hostility with anyone for the sake of the material body, for he would thus be no better than an animal, an aminal. And then Lord Chaitanya he's given us the key to entering into the holy name, and is that one must become tolerant like a tree and ready to offer all respects unto others, and one should be humble and not be hankering to be respected by others. Practically the antithesis of the false ego, or the person we imagine ourselves to be. That's how I like to describe it. The person that we're always imagining ourselves to be. From the time that we were born, everyone told us our name, right? And you're like this, and you're like that. And then by our different past experiences, we developed certain beliefs about ourselves. I'm like this, I'm like that. And we also develop different beliefs about other people and about the world. And those become our program, our computer program. The person we imagine ourselves to be is not real. It's a program there in the mind. And basically, based on that program, unless we're become conscious of it, we just tend to react unconsciously to that program. And so, if we want to enter into the holy name and experience ourself and our relationship with Krishna, we have to actually develop higher consciousness and cultivate. We want to cultivate humility and tolerance, because when we're humble, when we're tolerant, this is indicative of one who has higher consciousness. I'll speak more about this in a second. I used to think, when I was a devotee and when I first learned the Shikshastakam prayers, I thought that if I just kept repeating them, then I was going to become humble and tolerant and respectful. I thought by hearing. And it's true, we need to hear, but the realization or the effect of the hearing is manifest when we actually apply what we've heard, when we put it into action. You know? So, how do you become actively humble? It's a matter of a change of consciousness or an awakening of consciousness. This is described by Prabhupada in one purport. There's a story in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, I think it may be in the Adi Lila, where the devotees are having the Harinam. Well, they're having Sankirtan, congregational chanting, at the house of Srivas. And of course, not everyone can come in there, right? Only those who are pure in heart. Lord Chaitanya wouldn't have let anybody else in. And there was one Brahmin who became very envious because he wasn't allowed there. And so he wanted to defame Srivas. So he paid someone to, I think, you can correct me if I if I don't have the story correct, but he asked someone to make it appear as if Srivas was a worshipper of Kali. Right. And so once that was set up there, the devotees needed to purify the place, so they called a cleaning woman. I think they're called bungies. What is it? A hati. So she came, And when the lady came there, the cleaning lady came there, how did Lord Chaitanya and the other devotees respond to her? You remember? You know that story? They treated her with all respect. You know, even though she was just a cleaning woman. They treated her with great respect, and they moved out of her way and they let her clean everything. So Prabhupada talks about in the purport, he talks about how humility and tolerance and pridelessness and respect for others actually manifest from the soul. Of course, we can cultivate them on the level of the mind, and we should. But what does it mean that humility and tolerance and respect for others arises from the soul? What it means is from the awakening or the direct experience of our true self as the witnessing presence of awareness that we are. When one begins to experience oneself as the pure consciousness, it's just a tiny spark of the Supreme Lord, one realizes one's tininess. And from that perception of how tiny and insignificant one really is, as simply a ray coming from the Supreme Lord, a ray of light, a tiny ray of light, from that witnessing, from that awakening, one feels humble. And also, if there is some, you know, assault on the false ego, on the person we imagine ourselves to be, one can tolerate it without being disturbed. It's one thing to tolerate, but it's another thing to tolerate without being disturbed, which that's what Krishna recommends in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Matra sparshas tukunteya stitoshna sukadukada agama pahino nityas tamstitikshasvabharata. Krishna says, actually, you know, that happiness and distress come and go like winter and summer seasons, and they arise from sense perception. And one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. And I know as devotees, I think we focus a lot on the tolerant part. One must tolerate. But he says tolerate without being disturbed. And then in the next verse, he says, if you can tolerate without being disturbed, that's actual liberation. So just tolerating itself without higher consciousness is actually a form of suppression, which will actually, it can lead to just simply reinforcing one's imaginary sense of self. So I find it helpful when we're discussing this topic of developing humility and tolerance. I'm going to watch the time. And tolerance and respect for others and not requiring any respect for us. It's helpful to at least theoretically understand how the mechanism of the mind works. I call it the perfect mousetrap. How we're stuck and how it works. And it's that, of course, that theoretical understanding isn't going to liberate us, but at least if we theoretically understand how we're trapped, then we can begin to notice it. We begin to see it within ourselves. And that's higher consciousness, actually directly perceiving how it's going on within me. And then we have the opportunity to see beyond it. So basically the mind, when we say the mind, like Krishna says, right, in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 4, in chapter 7, verses 4 and 5, he makes a distinction.
Now I feel better.
He describes what is the material energy and what is the spiritual energy. So he says, Bhumir apanalo vayu kamano buddhar evacha ahamkara ityame binapakritura ashtada. So sometimes we separate the mind and the intelligence and the ego. So he says, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence and false ego. Sometimes when I say ego, I just mean the false ego. He says that these are my separated material energy. And then in the next verse he says, Aparayami tastvanyam prakritim vidhi me puram jiva bhutam mahabahoya yedam darite jagati. But he says there's a superior energy of mind, so it's also prakriti. But it's conscious. So in other words, the material energy is not conscious. The spiritual superior energy is conscious. And so when we see our own imaginary self, the mistake we make is to think that it's real or that it's conscious. But actually it's not. It's like artificial intelligence. It's just a program. But it's so expert that we think it's real. So anyway, the ego, the false ego and the mind and the intelligence, they're one unit. It's like the software of the hardware of the computer. And so the mind itself, there's four aspects to how this mousetrap works, how we're caught in it. And if we can understand it and perceive it in ourself, then we can see beyond it. So the mind itself is like a container. It's like a blank screen. In order to have this picture here, you have to have a background. Right? Without that background, you can't have the picture. And so all of our experiences, even our spiritual experiences, it's like when Mataji was telling me last night that when she first started chanting, she felt so happy. But then it disappeared. And she kept trying to get that experience again. But an experience only happens in the moment. Then the mind takes a picture of it and says, I want that. I want that again. But the mind can't do that. It has to. It's mercy when we have a little revelation or we experience some ecstasy in the kirtan. It's a gift to us. So anyway, whatever we've experienced in this life and in many lifetimes, there's a picture being made of that. Or it's called a samskar. But it's generally a material samskar. And that's manas. That's an aspect of the mind. It's a thought form. You know, a memory is a thought form. And based on that memory, a lot of times we imagine what the future is going to be. It's another thought form based on our memory of the past. And basically, within the mind are simply thought forms or memories of the past and imaginations about the future. And they're thought forms, and they're appearing on the screen of the mind, and we're there watching our own movie. Right? So that's one aspect of mind. And then, so, in order for that picture to be made, the first aspect of mind actually is perception. So as Vaisheshika Prabhu often says, as attention, where attention goes, energy flows. So wherever we put our attention, now the senses actually can perceive. That perception can occur. Just let me explain. Like I'm giving this talk right now. But if you're, checking your iPhone and looking at pictures from yesterday or something. If that's where your attention is, if that's where your attention is, you actually will not hear anything, right? Although the ear is there, there's no perception. And so the mind is called, sometimes called the sixth sense. So wherever It's the focusing mechanism. That's the first aspect of mind. And so without attention, there's no perception. So, but just say, for example, maybe you are listening to the class. So, the first aspect is this: you're actually hearing the sound. The next aspect of mind is interpretation. You interpret that sound. Now, how do we make our interpretation? Where's the interpretation coming from? It's coming from our program, our imaginary self. We interpret whatever we experience based on who we imagine ourselves to be, which is based on all of our past experiences. In other words, we don't really experience anything as it is. It gets filtered. Let me give you an example. Just say you walk in here and you say Hari Bol to me, and I go like this. Like you're not there. You saw me, right? There was perception. And then based on my body language, you made an interpretation. Based on who you imagine yourself to be. It's that Krishna says here, you shouldn't allow anyone. Yeah. You shouldn't become afraid of anyone or allow anyone to disturb you. And usually, however we're feeling, we're blaming the other person. We don't see that it's coming from our own mind, from our own imaginary self. So just the opposite. Just say you came in here and I gave you a big smile. Hey, Hari Bol, how are you today? Your ego also interprets that. And based on the so that's the intelligence. The intelligence is strategizing because the ego wants to feel safe because it's afraid because it doesn't know who he is. Right? We've forgotten who we are in our relationship with Krishna. We don't know our value. So we're always in a state of fear, trying to find our value in how people are reacting to us based on who we imagine ourselves to be. So that, based on that interpretation, which the intelligence is involved in, a lot of times we are strategizing way ahead of time how to get people to react to us, right? So that the ego can feel safe. I'll dress like this, I'll speak like this, I'll smile, even though maybe inside I'm feeling desperate. So it's just an unconscious pattern, you know, we've developed over lifetimes. So based on the interpretation, this is probably the most important part to understand. Based on the interpretation, the mind generates a feeling, an emotion. Devahuti mentioned this when she was speaking to Kapila. She said, I'm sick of this material world, and I'm based, and I can see how I'm addicted to sense gratification because of the feeling that's generated. It's the feeling that's catching my attention and keeping me stuck. So anyway, the mind generates the feeling, and based on the feeling, we experience happiness or distress. Right? If we feel pleasure or we feel pain. Right? If I don't smile at you, and you interpret that is that I don't care about you. Of course, maybe I'm just having a bad day or maybe I'm spaced out. But you interpret it, oh, he doesn't like me. Right? So based on that interpretation, that generates a feeling of pain or fear. Fear, pain, it's the same thing. There's a contraction in the mind that is reflected in the body. The mind and the body are one. And so the pain and the feeling that's generated in the mind gets actually reflected in the body as a sensation. If it's a pleasurable, it may be a pleasurable sensation of expansion, or it may be a painful sensation of fear. Because basically when we feel like others don't like us or others are judging us, you know, maybe superficially we become angry as a defense, you know, or we say, you know, you're no good anyway. I don't care what you think about me. But underneath, there's actual fear. And ultimately, fear of death. Fear of non-existence. But anyway, then here's the catcher. Here's the fourth aspect of mind. The mind generates a feeling that's reflected in the body. And then the mind detects the feeling and reacts to it, thinking, oh, this is real. And then the program stays like that. And pretty much this goes on unconsciously within us all the time. And unless we come to higher consciousness and begin to watch that and see that, we'll tend to just continually maintain that power, maintain that program. Or in devotee language, we would call that maintaining material attachment in spite of knowing otherwise. But it's the theory alone is not enough. We have to come to higher consciousness to see that. We do have to become introspective. Or as Prabhupada would say, this knowledge is meant for contemplation and realization. So another word for realization, would you be quiet? Another word for realization is real in my experience. Something you directly perceive. So I'm hearing that, right? And I don't like it. And then, yeah, if you notice it, you can feel. You could sense it in me. There's a tension there, right? It arises, and then, but if you bring your attention to it and look at it, at the feeling, consciously, then it disappears. And then, or you have the opportunity to let it go. And so, it's not like that we can just tolerate without being disturbed. No, there is a disturbance. Disturbance does arise based on our own conditioning. Disturbance will arise. And then when we bring it to consciousness, when we bring it into the light of our awareness and face it, then we're no longer reinforcing it. We're no longer unconsciously just reacting to it. And then we're starting to become aware of what our own conditioning is. And then we have choice. Up until that point, we don't have much choice. We'll just tend to reinforce it. But at that point, we have this choice to either react or not react, or even if the reaction has already started, we can watch it. And then that process of watching it and allowing it without reacting to it with attachment or aversion, that gradually weakens the program, and that leads to higher consciousness. Or, as Krishna would say in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 7, verse 27. Anyone know that verse? Just by hearing the name, just by hearing the number. Let me pass the microphone there.
Icha dvesha samutena dvandva mohina bharata. Sarva bhutani sammoham sarge yanti parantapa. Is that the one you wanted?
Yes. So icha, what does icha mean?
Desire.
And what does dvesha mean? Hate. Hate or aversion, right? Okay, so the mind reacts to its own creation with attachment and aversion. And Krishna says this is the cause of delusion and the experience of duality. Icha dvesha samutena dvandva mohena bharata sarva bhutani sammaham sarge yanti parantapaha. So, if I say, you know, I like you, oh, you sing so nicely, or how many books did you distribute today, Prabhuji or Mataji? And I praise you. The ego likes that, right? So it manifests a feeling of happiness, of pleasure. And in the body, it's a feeling of expansion. Like when you're feeling confident, you feel expansive. Yes, I can do it. But if we are feeling doubtful, there's a contraction. And then there's an unconscious habitual reaction to those feelings. We react with, I want more. Oh, tell me more. Smile some more. Or we react with rejection. But that reaction is going unconsciously. And in this way, the program remains reinforced as long as it goes on unconsciously. And so to develop humility, to develop tolerance, to actually begin to see others as, to respect others, and to not need or depend upon the praise of others, to not always be walking around. Because the ego is always strategizing. How can I get others to notice me? How can I get others to praise me? So association can be a double-edged sword, because in one sense, if we're serving Krishna in the false ego, then we're still wandering around trying to get praise, trying to feel good by external validation, which is continually just reinforcing the person we are imagining ourselves to be, unless we become aware of that. We can't really fight it or stop it. All we have to do is begin to notice it and watch it. That's enough to dissolve it, and then to dissolve that pattern. The pattern may continue to go on and on, but once we see it, then it doesn't have that effect upon us anymore, because then we have this choice. So association is so important, because it's within the association that not only do we get inspiration, but also we learn to tolerate each other. And it's inevitable when we're associating with each other that we'll neglect each other. Sometimes we'll say things we don't mean. This will stimulate our false ego, and then we'll see it. If we went to a cave and just chanted, all of this attachment and aversion we have just remains sleeping there. You know, it's not going away. It's just asleep. And as soon as you come out of that cave and you have to go stand in line at the bank to get rupees or something, it'll all come out. Right? You'll thought, oh, I was chanting there in ecstasy, and now I've come out, and what is all of this? Yes, it's always been there. Yeah, because at moment to moment, we keep it going. Unconsciously, or even consciously. You know, we don't really, you know, start to deal with it. We don't want to. Because basically, this reaction of the mind, this feeling that arises based on our interpretation of events, is we react to it very quickly with either expression or suppression. The feeling itself, we don't deal with. Dealing with the feeling through the body is really the key to waking up, to face this feeling, because that's the glue that keeps it all stuck together. And it's very difficult to look at the thoughts in the mind and not become lost there. So the body is actually, it's meant for, so I have the saying, we use the body to transcend the body. We can use, the body is also helpful for chanting, because the body can keep us present for Krishna when we chant. So, the body is always a true reflection of what's going on in the mind. The ego can be very tricky, you know, and just project things and blame others. But when this pleasure or pain arises in the body based on the false ego, we can feel it, and if we bring our attention to that pain and we don't run away from it and we acknowledge it and accept it and we say, yes, this, I'm generating this, then we're not reacting unconsciously, and then we're starting to see the pattern of the ego that we're stuck in. Otherwise, we tend to reinforce it. And to, it's the same, as long as we keep doing that and not taking responsibility for it, it will tend to be reinforced over and over again, in spite of all of our spiritual activities, even in spite of chanting. It's similar, you know, to taking a bath. If we're actually chanting purely and just hearing the holy name, when we're present, there is actually no false ego. We're in a state of pure consciousness. But as soon as we become lost in the mind and our attention drifts off into the imaginary self, then even while we're chanting, we're lost in who we imagine ourselves to be, and we're thinking, oh, this person said that, this person said this, and we're living in that mousetrap, reinforcing it. Or even worse, if we're doing that while we're chanting, Lord Chaitanya compares that to pouring water, right? The chanting of the holy name is the water that nourishes the bhakti plant. But unless you pour it on the plant, if you pour it somewhere else, what's it going to nourish? It nourishes the weeds, because we're super concentrated, right? More than usually we're just walking around distractedly thinking and kind of maintaining our imaginary self. But when we're chanting and we're focused, if we get into some dream about this or that while we're chanting, it really is pouring water on the weeds. That dream that we're in gets more solidified. So anyway, I'd just like to go over with you one more time. Does anybody remember the four aspects of mind that we just talked about? Maybe some of you have heard me say this before. What comes first? Yeah. Well, let's pass the microphone around. Let's see.
Perception. Is that the first one?
Yes.
And then interpretation?
Yes.
Based on the mind and the type of program that we've cultivated and maintained?
Yeah.
And then I forgot the feelings and emotions?
Yeah.
And then bodily reaction?
Yes. Thank you. So the perception, everyone say perception.
Perception.
Interpretation.
Feeling.
And reaction. This is karma at its most basic level. We're reacting to what is generated within our own mind and then believing that it's true. So I'll just give you an example from my own experience again about programming. So, and devotees have heard me give this
example many times, but I'm still recovering from the trauma. So when I was in the second grade, I had this teacher. Her name was Mrs. White. She was a big lady. My name is Matthew Whitmore. So she called me Whitmore. And one day I didn't turn in my homework. And she said, "Whitmore, you're stupid." Yeah, talk about belittling someone, huh? And then she made me wear a sign all day long. This would never happen now. She made me wear a sign all day long, "I am stupid." Yeah. So I was like 7 years old, you know. And to this day, you know, even when I get up in front of others or when I'm around, especially God brothers that are so articulate and smart, I feel very inferior. And that's all, you know. Of course, I can speak theoretically. Yes, you know, that's coming from this image I have of myself. But we have hundreds of those experiences, you know. Some of them are so powerful, they're even affecting us from the last life, you know. So it's a heavy energy. And chanting purifies that. Or it's like, Krishna Shatamaraj says, you know, the chanting opens your eyes, or the guru opens your eyes. But then we have to make the effort to keep our eyes open. So that fear, if I just think theoretically, oh, that's my conditioning, that won't do anything. But if I take a moment to feel that fear I feel before I get up and speak to everyone, then I'm consciously dealing with that and just allowing it to arise and pass away. And the more you do that, the more you are not reinforcing it, then the more light you have and the more you see, and the easier it is to actually surrender and let go. So that's what it means to let go. To see the wanting to hold on to it, or the wanting to get rid of it and not feel it, not deal with it. And then to see it and then let it go, that's freedom. That's actual surrender. And from that arises the awareness that I'm that life energy. I'm that divine consciousness that's part of Krishna. That's tiny, but it's completely valuable. And it's as valuable as everybody else. No better, no worse. And because it's so valuable, we can automatically offer our respects to others, and we no longer require validation from others to feel good about ourselves. Because internally we enjoy being a little tiny dust, piece of dust at the lotus feet of the Lord. What more could we want? So within that is actual security, safety, satisfaction. Everything that we're looking for outside is there inside. I know that's a cliche, but it's true. But if we're in contact with that, then out of that, humility, tolerance, respect for others, and no need to respect for yourself arises automatically when we're perceiving our true self. And at the simultaneously, what's the verse, Vaishprabhu, in the Isha Upanishads? It says that one must cultivate nisciyance and knowledge side by side.
Eleven. Vidyam cha vidyam chayas tadvedo bayam saha avidyayam ritum tirtva vidyayam ritum ashnute.
Thank you.
Only one who can learn the process of nescience and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. Mm-hmm.
So we not only have to see what we're not, we have to see what we are. Or we not only have to see what we are, simultaneously we see what we're not. 以上, 1B. So I'll turn it over for any reflections or questions. Yes, Mataji. Vrindavan Vinodini? Mataji.
Thank you so much, Prabhu. I wanted to just double check that I heard something correctly, and if so, if maybe you could expand on it. So you gave this beautiful analogy of this perfect mouse trap, and it's composed of these four things that take place. And then I believe you mentioned that if we are not actually able to become conscious and recognize what is taking place, that this is actually what is meant by maintaining material attachments. Could you please elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, so, you know, the material attachment, a lot of times we think of that as the gross things, like our house and, significant people we're attached to, or having a nice car and clothes. But really the attachment is the attachment to who we imagine ourselves to be. We imagine ourselves to be separate from Krishna, to be independent of Him. And that attachment exists in our mind, in our memory, as our conditioning. And that's, as long as we keep reinforcing it and living in that imaginary self, we're maintaining our material attachments. And even if we let go of the gross things we're attached to, you know, the subtlest thing is being attached to false prestige and being honored and validated by others. That's pretty much what we're looking for in all the external things we have, right? And we're always in the mind. The mind, the ego is always strategizing, you know, how to get those things from others. And unless we, you know, only we can become conscious of that and change that. But it's the natural evolution of consciousness to come to that point, like we were talking about in the previous class, because that gets old. You know, no matter how much validation you get externally, it's never enough, right? And you just want more and more. And underneath that is always a state of fear and discomfort. So there's really no peace, there's really no happiness, and eventually we have to come to a point and say, I'm so tired of this. I don't want to play this game anymore. I just want to be real, I want to be authentic. I'm just going to be myself. And people can, you know, say my tilak's crooked or not. Or, you don't have tilak on, Prabhu. Uh-oh. You know, all of these things, we just want to become honest and authentic. And this is why I was talking about this in Beijing. Sometimes I talk about Sangha is not only the place where we're hearing and chanting, not to get off into another thing, but Sangha should be, and to me, what we have here is a Sangha, because a Sangha is a place where we feel safe enough to be ourself so that we can reveal our weaknesses to each other. And when we're able to confide in other devotees, then we're able to see the ego and to let it go. A lot of times it's hard to see, you know, if we're just bouncing around in our mind. But when we make a confession to another devotee, then it comes out of there and we can really look at it. And what we're doing basically is bringing it into consciousness. The light of consciousness is what will dissolve that. And so that's what I mean by maintaining material. So it's in the Sangha, in a group of devotees that are honest, and that are not trying to force you to be anything. that accept you the way you are, where you feel free, safe to expose yourself and to ask for help. That's also a sangha.
Thanks so much, Prabhu. I would like to know how you think we can develop a sangha like that in the ISKCON society now, which many people, being a part of ISKCON for a long time, had experiences like you had with Mrs. White themselves, with authorities. And I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's very sad also when you actually try to help people, especially new people, and how those old experiences get thrust upon them and those misconceptions that develop because of it become their habituations in Krishna consciousness. So how can we, especially in the society of devotees, apply what you've been talking about today? Because they sound like nice principles to apply when we're at the bank, but when we're at the temple, it seems like many people put them out the window.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little difficult, especially in a temple. I think it's, oh, first time I've seen monkeys here. Yeah. So we... You know the cliche, right? If you want to change the world, change yourself, right? So if you want to improve the association of devotees, you have to start. We have to start with ourselves, and then we associate with those who inspire us and who we can feel safe with, and then we create that sangha. And a lot of times, I think it's important. It's hard to do that within the temple itself. So it's important for devotees to get together outside of the temple, just like in a retreat like this, and spend time with each other. Not only hearing and chanting, but taking walks, cooking together, swimming together, even playing a little sports together, having prasadam together, where there's no expectations except just to be present with each other. And just to be as authentic and as real as possible, and make an effort to be very honest, and to create that feeling of respect and acceptance. That's how I feel, especially, I'm sure you all do, with Vaisheshika Prabhu and Nirkula. I've always, no matter all the faults and all my little idiosyncrasies, and I have a real resistance towards organizations and authorities. And if I feel like there's any expectation put upon me, I feel like doing just the opposite, you know. And I got to a point where I felt like I was becoming so mechanical and that I was just responding mechanically. Yes, Hari Bol, please accept my humble obeisances. I was just... all of these expected ways of behavior, if you're doing them, I'm not saying not to do them. It's kind of like being attached to the rules and regulations or rejecting the rules and regulations. We have to be conscious and do things authentically and not mechanically just because they're expected by others and that we want to meet everyone's expectations. So I think we just have to start with ourselves and start within our own group and spend time with each other outside the temple and not always chanting and hearing and doing Harinam and these things, but just being with each other without any expectation. Hare Krishna. Yes, Malini.
Thank you, Prabhuji. I was just reflecting back on what you told about tolerance without being disturbed versus suppression. So some time ago, I was when I was working with a devotee in my service, I was thinking I was tolerating a lot because there are different ways of how people do things. And I was tolerating, but I was disturbed a lot within myself. And I thought, like, how is that? It's not helping because I'm tolerating. But then recently I just decided that I'll do this happily. And then I think that was the real tolerance I was doing, that is without disturbing. But I just realized after your lecture that I was doing mostly suppression rather than tolerance. So this was very helpful. Now I can see the difference. And if I do things going forward in tolerance, I will try to implement it without being disturbed rather than suppressing it.
So you became aware of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And so then you, once you become aware of it, you're not suppressing it. And then the other thing is it doesn't mean, tolerance doesn't mean that we don't speak up sometimes. And we explain to another Prabhuji or Mataji in a nonviolent way, this is happening, and I'm feeling like this, and then make a humble request. Again, you're bringing everything to consciousness. And then when we do that, that opens up the opportunity for others to also express honestly how they're feeling, so that we become aware of, you know, the effect we're having on others, and that we deepen our understanding and then improve the relationships. So it's important to speak up, but in a nonviolent way. Okay, thanks. I think we're 3 minutes over. So thank you very much for listening today and for your participation. All glories to Prabhupada and all glories to Srimad Bhagavatam and all glories to the Sangha devotees. Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.